You are listening to the ODAT Chat podcast. On this podcast, my guests share their stories of alcoholism, addiction, and how they recovered so that you can too. My hope is that you find the inspiration and resources you need to let go of what's holding you back so that you can transform into the person you were always meant to be. Ready? Here we go. Hey friends, thank you for downloading the podcast. My name is Arlena and I'll be your host. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes or Google Play to hear more inspiring stories about recovery every week. You can also get them delivered right to your email inbox. Just sign up for the newsletter at odatchat.com. For those of you who know me, you know I can't have an intro without at least one resource. So today I'm going to share an amazing book called Radical Acceptance by Tara Brach. They say acceptance is the key to all our problems, and this book has such deep wisdom that I find myself listening to it over and over again. I actually listened to the Audible version because number one, her voice is so soothing and calming. She's amazing. And number two, because I'm doing the 75 hard challenge and I need something to listen to while I work out. Lord help me. Anyway, if you try it, I hope you like it. Today, my guest is Casey Davidson, life and recovery coach and podcast host of the Hello Someday podcast. Is that the best name for a podcast or what? I love it. Casey is a loving wife and mother of two beautiful kids. She's super smart, creative, and hardworking, yet she struggled with the amount of alcohol she was consuming. And as successful as she was in the corporate world, she knew there was something wrong with the way she was drinking, which began her journey to recovery. Her story is as unique as she is, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Casey. Well, Casey, thank you so much for joining me on the ODAT Chat podcast.
I am so excited to be here, Arlena. It's such a privilege.
I met you through She Recovers, and yes. I did a podcasting class, and then we're doing a podcast. I want to call it an evil mastermind group, but it's not an evil.
It's definitely a mastermind. Evil.
Okay, a mastermind group. We're on a mission to heal the world, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. So you are a sober life coach. You really help professional women gain clarity and focus and help them prioritize what they need to do so they can reach their goals. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Yeah. I work with a lot of working moms. So women who are pretty successful in their careers, who've climbed the corporate ladder. I would say almost all of us sort of identify as people pleasers / overachievers, which is sort of a pretty common combination. And they're busy. They do everything for everyone else. They try to make sure that all the balls are in the air. And yet they feel drained and they feel stuck and they feel, you know, they just don't love their day-to-day life, even though they love all the people and things in it. And really looking at what's behind that. And most of the women, actually all of the women I coach, want to quit drinking. And they, you know, have gotten to the point where they know that drinking is no longer working in their lives. And yet they have so much fear about quitting, both about what, you know, they wonder, am I bad enough to quit? They wonder what it will do to their social life, to their marriage, all their friends drink. They actually worry about whether it will hurt their career to stop drinking, which is crazy, but I had those same fears because, you know, if they stop, somehow that's admitting they have a problem. And, you know, even though you're not going to work hungover and tired and your brain's sharper and you remember more and you don't drink too much at social events with workers, you're worried that if you stop drinking, everybody's going to be like, ooh, what happened? So yeah. Those women I work with.
Yeah. And just to add on to that piece, it's like, I'm in sales, right? Yeah. Like I work for a company out of Silicon Valley in high tech sales, and drinking is a big part of the sales career, but I have learned nobody cares.
Yes.
Nobody cares. Yes. It's like I walk around with a club soda and cranberry with a lime in it, and everyone just assumes it has booze in it. Like, and nobody cares. It's like, oh, what can I get you to drink? And I'm like, oh, I'm just drinking this tonight. I have an early morning. And they're like, okay.
When
like,
nobody cares. People who care have their own issues with alcohol. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there, both about how to talk about it and
right.
how to stop judging yourself about it, ways to get over being uncomfortable, how to deal with people who do yeah. care. You know, there are certainly some, and also how to sort of do the real observation of once people are three or four drinks in, like you're not really helping yourself in your career anyway. Like people exactly. don't remember what they say. You think they're bonding the next morning and it's cringeworthy. I mean, I certainly had all the cringeworthy moments where I'm like, this actually, I think it's helping my career. It's not, you know?
Yeah, totally not. Yeah. And men can be really inappropriate when they're drinking and it's easy to just be like, man, I don't care. You know, like when you're drinking, like,
yeah.
So yeah, not good. Not good for anybody. And especially if you actually do have a problem, what if you realize, oh shoot, I do. Like, I mean, I can't tell you how many like sales kickoffs I've been to where the next day people are like, oh my God, these two people, did you see those two people? They left together. Like
yes.
everybody knows, like, they were like, wow, they were really drunk and they left together. It's like, everybody knows what happens. It just puts you in such a bad light.
And people remember that for a decade. I mean, it is gossiped.
Forever. I have a friend who is a strategic sales guy for a very high profile company. And, you know, he's been sober probably 10, 15 years now. And people still bring it up to him. The craziness that was his identity back 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Still talk
and,
about it. So,
you know, that is not to say that if you're in that place or you've done those things, that you need to feel shame and need to worry about it for the rest of your career or life. But it is to say that it's better when you stop drinking, especially if you worry about it and your reputation and your productivity at work and your ability to do your job without so much anxiety is so much improved when you stop drinking.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah. And I do feel there is a difference between feeling shame about like if something bad does happen, like there is a difference between feeling shame about it and then using that experience to keep you from doing it again.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
Like that's the purpose of pain. It's like, you don't put your hand on a hot stove because it burns. And
yeah.
I tell my girls sometimes, I'm like, you know what? Let that shit burn you. Let it burn for a minute because the next time you start to think, well, maybe it'll be okay this time. Or if I'll just drink a glass of water between drinks, or you start to think about, and then you go, wait a minute. That was so painful. I'm never doing that again.
Yeah.
You know? If you let it burn,
yeah, and I do a lot of like reflection, and I do this with my clients too, on how fun was it? How good was it? I mean, I definitely remember, you know, couple friends with younger kids doing a sleepover, right? Like once you have kids, seeing your friends is harder. And so we planned this great sleepover at our house. They brought their kids, stayed in our guest room. And I'd been looking forward to this for months. And of course, we were drinkers. We started drinking at like 4 p.m. as soon as they got here. And I put the kids to bed, read them stories, totally drunk/buzzed, whatever you want to call it. We weren't driving, and fell asleep with them. And
with the kids?
Yeah, because I was drunk. Like, you know, like
7 or 8 at night.
It was like 9. Mm-hmm. But my husband and the couple stayed up for hours. They went for a walk in the moonlight. They looked at shooting stars, right? I missed all of it, and came downstairs in the morning, totally hungover. And my girlfriend who runs marathons was out running. And I just was like, how fun was that? Like I literally blew the night I'd been looking forward to in months. So, you know, in terms of shame, I feel like doing that, like drinking, not drinking reflection. Because now I do things with my friends all the time. And yes, I don't get that like drunk buzz, but I get so much more. I get to see the shooting stars. I get to remember it. I feel great in the morning. And once you're sort of over the hump, you get all that true moments of joy and contentment and pride that you don't get when you're drinking.
Can't agree more, 100%. Yeah. All good reasons not to drink, right?
Right. Yeah.
I don't usually start the conversation that way, but I'm glad that we, no. I mean, I could talk to you forever. And typically we do talk forever.
Yes.
What I would love to hear is sort of like a little bit of your background, your experience, your personal experience with drinking. Like, yeah. How old were you when you started? Like, when did you cross the line? Like, if you got to the core issue of why you started in the first place, or
yeah,
that kind absolutely. Of thing would be great. I'm not going to interrupt you. I'm going to let you tell your story uninterrupted, and then I'll quiz you at the end.
Okay. That sounds good. Yeah. Well, I quit drinking for the last time, knock on wood, 4.5 years ago. So I quit when I was 40 years old. I did not drink a ton in high school because I grew up, my parents were in the Foreign Service. They were diplomats overseas. We moved every 2 or 3 years to different countries, different continents. I spent a lot of time, you know, when I was 3 to 5 in Mozambique in Southern Africa, and then we moved to Paraguay in South America, and then Zambia in Southern Africa and all around. And so when growing up, it was really important that I was sort of the good girl, that I didn't have a lot of needs. My parents were very, very busy with their jobs. That was clearly the most important thing in their lives. And I just, you know, was the smiley, happy younger sister, mostly because my older sister, had some anger and resentments and about us moving. So, you know, you take on whatever the role is that isn't taken in the family. So much of a people pleaser. I remember when I was, you know, 8 years old, my parents would go play tennis in Sunday mornings. And we always had like a housekeeper/nanny, right? My parents had a lot of social events. They worked really late and on weekends. And my parents would go play tennis, and I would spend the entire time they were gone cleaning the house. And this, we had a housekeeper, right? Because we lived in South America, super common. And they would come back and I would pretend that I hadn't done it. So they would express all this surprise and joy. And I was 8 years old. Like, the amount of things that I was doing to get love and attention from my parents were crazy. I have a 6-year-old and a 12-year-old now. Trust me, they are not cleaning the house to get my love when I leave the home. So, you know, there was a lot of like worry that if I wasn't good enough, I wouldn't have security, emotional or even physical. When I was 8 years old, we were going to move again. And the way the Foreign Service works is you basically bid on posts and they tell you where you're going to go. And my parents were both in the Foreign Service. My mom also worked, which was somewhat unusual. So they needed to get postings together. So I remember when I was 8, the choices were Zambia in Southern Africa, which is where we ended up going, or Saudi Arabia. And my parents told me and my sister, very matter of fact, that if we moved to Saudi Arabia, she and I would go to boarding school 5 days a week and take the train home on the weekends. And the amount of anxiety and stress and hurt that came from that was just unprocessed and real. So, you know, I basically, you know, went to boarding school when I was in high school. My sister and I did not have, you know, we were not, for some reason, each other's soft place to fall. Later, we kind of figured out why a little bit more. But, you know, she thought, you know, I was always trying to get my parents' positive attention, and she was trying to get their attention in negative ways. So I went to boarding school, a different boarding school than she did. It was my choice in a different state. And it was months after I turned 14. And I've pretty much been on my own since then. I would visit my parents 3 times a year. And, you know, remember very clearly talking to them on a payphone for 10 minutes once a week. So I was very successful. I got all A's. I was always trying to ingratiate myself to my friends and my friends' parents so that I would have somewhere to go on long weekends when the campus shut down. And I just had all this internal anxiety, like I call it hypervigilance. I felt like I needed to check things 17 times to make sure I was right and not going to let anything falling through the cracks. I mean, I had to fly down to Brazil when I was 14 years old by myself. I didn't speak Portuguese. I somehow once left my ticket and my passport in a phone booth in Rio de Janeiro, which is a huge airport, and was just in tears and beside myself. And so all that is to say, I didn't drink a lot in high school, almost at all, mostly because I was terrified of getting expelled or suspended. I had nowhere to go in my mind. And so super good girl. And then senior year, actually junior year, now that I think about it, I went to my girlfriend's house and her parents were somehow away and there were seven of us and we drank. And it was like my first time drinking. And for some, I just wanted to get drunk. I wanted to get drunk so bad to get out of my own head and to like have fun and have adventures and not be so responsible. So we played Drink While You Think. What, you know, that thing, that game with, you know, your red solo cups with Bacardi rum. Like it was not beer. And I was so excited to get drunk and to be bad. I blacked out the entire night. I apparently threw up all night long, all over myself. I was trying to climb up a small hill for the whole night. My friends carried me to bed. And I was so brutally hungover the next day, I thought I was going to die. And my dad, so that was my first time drinking. My dad picked me up the next day. I adored my father, adored him, like just wanted his love and attention so bad. And he did love me. He was affectionate. He just was never there. And he picked me up for, it was my sister's high school graduation weekend. And I was, you know, 16. So it was like, Casey, you can drive. I was shaking. I was awful. I had to somehow pretend I wasn't hungover and like pull over on the side of the road to throw up in the woods. I know it's bad, your face. And so, I went to my sister's graduation. My mother was there. My father was there. My grandparents. I mean, I had not seen my parents in 4 months until that day. And I remember my sister, I spent the whole time like desperately trying not to throw up. My sister was walking down the path with her graduating class. And I jumped up. I ran in front of them to the side of the building, threw up on the side of the building. I'm sure everyone could see, ran around, threw up on the back of the building. So that was my first time drinking. I came back to the seats. I mean, so desperately tried to play off that I've never told this story outside of like friends and family. So this is crazy that I'm going down here. And my mother, the only thing she said to me, my dad thought it was very funny. And the only thing my mother said to me was, you could have picked a more appropriate time. Like that was it. My dad thought it was hysterical. My dad's favorite line, and again, I adored him, was the line from Animal House that was, my advice to you is to start drinking heavily. He thought it was funny. He did not have a drinking problem. He was not a big, you know, they always had wine at dinner. That was like always in my household growing up. The adults had wine at dinner. I thought that's what they did. They had big dinner parties, you know, in the diplomatic corps with guests. It was part of their job. There was always like talking and revelry. And I used to like go to sleep with that and think that was the best sound in the whole wide world, adults talking and clinking glasses and just the loudness of voices in the home. But he was, you know, neither of my parents had a drinking issue. My sister doesn't. But for me, that was both, you know, you would think that would turn me off from drinking. It did not. I mean, it should have. Oh my God, I was so ill and mortified and embarrassed. And, you know, my goal is to have my parents think I'm amazing. And clearly that was not what happened. But you know, I was so wanting to get out of my own head and wanting to get out of my own responsibility and wanting to not be hypervigilant about everything. And so I went to college, you know, again, like just super, I felt like I had to be responsible for myself. I had to find someone to take me in. I had to, where was I going to live this summer after college? All the things. And so I went to college and, you know, in high school, I played field hockey and lacrosse. And in college, I decided to play women's rugby. They hung out with the boys and I was like not that comfortable with boys. They had these incredible rituals that now I cringe. You know, we sang all these songs that are total rape culture songs. I mean, I was, you know, just, you don't even want to know the lyrics, but they are, I won't say them because they're so inappropriate. I still memorized all the songs. And it was really fun. But we would go on keg runs after every game. We would party with the other team and party with the boys. And these were like sing song, chug drinks. The goal was almost to black out and throw up. There was a thing called boot and rally where you drink, throw up, keep drinking. That was very celebrated. We used to chug if you scored a goal, a try out of an old cleat. It was called shooting the boot. You know, we did keg stands. We did, some guys would get naked in a song that encouraged people to take off their clothes. It was always the guys. So that's somehow better. And then we'd pour all beer all over their naked body. So just to say it was a big drinking culture. And that's probably too much information. But I was a very, very still good girl, like good girl, like, you know, the hangovers, the gray outs, but I never did. I was never promiscuous. I barely went home with people. I didn't even lose my virginity until I was senior in college. Like I was just a good girl because I think I was so worried about being embarrassed and worried about not being in control. So drinking was my way to let loose and to get out of my own head and to be a rebel. And so that's what I did. And I also spent every night out around the keg in the library, got straight A's, all the things. So I loved it. And then I graduated college and again was super worried. I'd have nowhere to go. Like other people were going home and I just was like, I have to get a job. I have to figure out where to live. My parents were in Australia and Mozambique at the time. They got separate separate assignments, very different continents. And I moved down to DC. I got my first job at a consulting firm and worked. And my first assignment was a nightmare. It was calling Germany at 3 a.m. to find out in German air purification, respirator manufacturing stuff. I mean, it was ridiculous. And I felt like I had to do a great job and I had to get all the information and it had to be right. And so I would go home at night in my basement apartment and I would drink red wine. And I couldn't even cook. I'd been to boarding school, high school, and college, like eating in dorms. Like I literally didn't know how to make anything. I made mac and cheese and drank red wine. And that was my drinking. I felt sophisticated. It helped me not worry about my job. My dad that year got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and was told he had 6 months to live and he was in Australia. And my mother told me not to come home. She said, you have a job, you have to be responsible. You know, my sister also tried to commit suicide in high school. And I was in Germany at the time on exchange. And I desperately wanted to come home. I was beside myself. My parents were in Brazil at the time. They went to see her and again, told me not to come back. They told me they just needed to focus on my sister. And, you know, in my mind, they couldn't deal with me. even though I needed to be with her, we had talked the day before on the phone, the day before she tried to kill herself. And I had no clue. She told me I needed to be strong. And, you know, so it was hard. And yet I was like, what do I have to complain about? My life is so good. I have a job, you know, in my family, like feeling sorry for yourself or not being strong or not looking on the positive was not allowed. And so, or encouraged, it was just like, you know, we were sort of waspy, like, you know, don't talk about things, like put a happy face on it. Like it was just, and my parents loved me. I mean, they did. And my mom is wonderful and intelligent and driven and, you know, all the things. She just, for me, wasn't the soft place to fall. And never, you know, it, whether that was her, whether that was me, I mean, they just weren't home. They weren't around. That's just a fact. So I started drinking wine every night, and I was so nervous about work that I would drink the night before business trips, and I would literally be up all night dry heaving, like throwing up yellow bile before I had to go on a plane to New York City to American Express at the age of 25 and present. And in my mind, it was almost a strategy. Like I would be so hungover and trying not to be ill that I couldn't be worried about presenting. I mean, it was just so convoluted. Looking back, I can't imagine how much harder I was making everything for myself my whole life, and how much I was self-sabotaging, and you know, now fueling my anxiety and making myself so physically ill all the time. And, you know, then I met my husband, my boyfriend at the time. We moved out to Seattle together. I never would have left my job, even though I didn't love it, because I was so security oriented. But he was going to leave and said, you're coming with me or you're not. And I was like, okay. So, you know, I got a great job. They moved me out here. I worked in tech and I just drank every night. I mean, at the time we were young, we had fun, we would go kayak, but like every night we drank. And it was like us playing grown up. And that was just my life for the next, till I was 40, right? We went on wine tasting weekends. We had dinner parties with tons of wine. We had beer at football games. We went kayaking and drank in the kayaks. Like it was fun. It was a lot of fun. And I knew it was a problem, right? I didn't know that for a long time. I thought it was normal. I surrounded myself with a ton of drinkers. I, of course, woke up at 3 a.m. with crushing anxiety and thought it was my job and thought I was just working so hard. I went to therapists and got sleeping pills. You know, like I didn't actually put it together. I didn't put together the anxiety and the 3 a.m. wake-ups with my drinking. I literally thought drinking was helping me cope with my life and cope with my stress. My dad actually ended up living 6 years with pancreatic cancer. It was incredible. He got, he had a Whipple procedure back in the early days, never did chemo until the end. His last 3 years were like experimental treatments and not good. But for 3 years, he was good. He moved to Mozambique. He lived with my mom while she was working. We joke he was the house husband. He like got all the newspapers when she was at work in the morning, highlighted all the relevant articles so she could come home and read them. I mean, my parents are a little weird. He ended up getting sick and dying when I was 29. And again, totally crushing to me, but I drank my way through it. Would get drunk a bottle of wine and would cry and all the things. And then the next morning would pull myself together. And that was just me. I had my son when I was 32. And that was the time that I read Drinking a Love Story on my Kindle and just wrote myself a letter in a Word doc saying, I think I have a drinking problem. I think this is bad. I mean, every word of it resonated with me and I need to stop. And then like 5 days later, I went back into that Word doc. I still have it and wrote, just kidding, not a problem. I was overreacting. Like literally wrote myself like, no, you don't have a problem. And, you know, I was 32. It took till I was 38 to finally do my sustained first attempt at quitting drinking. And the whole time I thought all my issues were work-related, right? I worked in tech. There were a ton of layoffs. I had a little kid. It was stressful. Like all the things you think are the issues. And that I drank every wine and the wine every night because it was my one treat because I didn't get to go to yoga or go to guitar lessons or all the things I used to do. But it was getting worse and worse. I was feeling doomed. I was feeling like I couldn't cope with life. I was having, you know, the little and big things started to slip. I was having a lot of conflict with my new male boss who was in sales. I was in product marketing, very different, very oil and water. At work. And I sort of got counseled out of my very high level job that I'd been at for 5 years. And we decided to separate the company and myself. And I got, you know, 4 months paid. And so I was like, I got to get my shit together. I went to a therapist and said, okay, I've got all these things I want to work on. I have this stressful job. I have a little kid. I have so much anxiety, so much on my shoulders, you know, all the things. And by the way, I drink too much. And he was like, yeah. Let's talk about your drinking. He was an AA and I'd specifically chosen him because he said he worked with anxiety and addiction, right? So I wanted to talk about my anxiety, but was honest about my drinking and he encouraged me to go to AA. I also found for the first time an online secret Facebook group that I adore called the Booze Free Brigade, the BFB, and shared my story there, you know, with a picture of me and my son who was 5 at the time and said, here's what's going on with me. I'm, you know, 38 and I have a beautiful 5-year-old and I'm married and I drink a bottle plus of wine a night and my anxiety's off the chart and I'm worried about it, but I'm terrified and I desperately don't want to stop drinking. And 25 women said me too. And 25 women said, my story is just like yours. And 25 women said, your son is beautiful and it's going to be okay. And I get it. And just don't drink and we're here for you and post every day. Like I was in tears. I took screenshots of every single comment and posted them in a Word doc. Okay. I was kind of a Word doc girl. So I've been on the BFB since then. That was 7 years ago. They held me up and supported me. And there was a woman on there who was my age and a lawyer and lived in Seattle. And she went to AA and she was 4 months sober. So she invited me to AA. I was sort of like, oh, bucket list. Never thought I'd do this. You know, like check that one off. So I went with her. She was wonderful. I went to AA for maybe 4 or 5 months. I was off work. So I went 4 times a week to midday women's meetings. I went to a lot of big book study meetings, which for me, I think might have been a mistake. I'm not very religious. I don't love organized religion. It's not my bag. And for better or worse, the big book reminded me a lot of that. I just didn't. And I know you're an AA, Arlena, and adore it. And it's wonderful. And I know so many women who have been so helped by it. Where I was at the time, and I don't think it's unusual for people to come in this way, I just didn't buy into a lot of the dogma, a lot of the philosophy. I had a lot of resistance there. I didn't want to say I was an alcoholic. I wasn't even sure I was an alcoholic. And to this day, I just don't think the word is useful to me. I just don't think it's necessary for me. I know, you know, in my mind, I don't fuck with alcohol anymore. It is not, it's dangerous to me. I clearly was addicted to it, but in my mind, I became addicted to an addictive substance, which is exactly what it's designed to do. So, you know, I don't think that you stop smoking and say you're a nicotineaholic. Like, just for me, that's my bag. So I didn't love saying that. I was such a people pleaser that of course I did. And I got a sponsor. I did a first couple steps, and then I got pregnant with my daughter and went back to work at a corporate job that was a long commute away, and kind of was like, okay, you know, my boss actually at my corporate job was in AA, had quit drinking 20 years before. She knew. I talked to her about it. We'd worked together many times before. So she was kind of my support and my accountability. Plus I was pregnant. So, I mean, I just didn't drink for a year. I was healthier and happier, and kind of after the year decided that, oh, just kidding. I don't have a problem with alcohol. I was just in a really stressful place. I'm better now. And the truth is I just wanted to drink. I mean, that is the truth. And I was kind of shocked that my husband and other people let me do the like slow shuffle away, considering I'd been to AA. I mean, you know, it's like, that's not a small step. I went back to drinking for about 22 months, and really quickly it was a bottle of wine a night or more with a tiny baby and a kid, you know, who was six. And the whole time I knew it was unsustainable. The whole time I, you know, they say recovery ruins you for drinking. I knew too much. I never in those 22 months had a picture of me with a wine glass on social media. Like, I was very careful. I would go to the grocery store and buy the six pack, you know, because you got 10 minutes, you know, 10% off if you get six, and would buy it and lay it down and hide it with my grocery bags and look around when I was checking out in case anyone from AA was there. I mean, just the ridiculousness of it all. And finally at 20, when she was 22 months old, I just felt doomed. And I felt like I was really going to fuck up my life and my marriage and my kids. And it was going to be my fault. And I was worried for my mental health. I really was. I, you know, would go to work and something would happen, and I would think I want to shoot myself, which, you know me, Arlena, I am a very optimistic, happy, positive person. And it was all the alcohol. And so I hired a coach. I had heard about this 100-day sober challenge. I signed up for it. I sent her an email. I did phone calls with her. I said I was going to do 100 days. I went back to the Booze Free Brigade, checked in there every day, and that was my last day one. I did 100 days. Then I said, okay, I'm going for 6 months. Then I said, okay, I'm going for a year. And then I said, I'm done. So that's my story. That was probably longer than you wanted.
Wasn't I was hanging on your every word. That was amazing. And I have so many questions. I was taking notes. No. Did you see me taking all these notes?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
No. That's
good. I'm like a page and a half. Oh my. No, I mean, oh my gosh. As you were talking about how you grew up, I mean, I wanted to cry a little bit when you were talking about just the impact of the absentee parent, right? Yeah. And it wasn't that, I mean, you're very clear that your parents loved you when you were with them, but to not be a priority, I mean, I know you to be and correct me if I'm wrong, but I know you to be a child-centered family.
Oh, we are. You know, you always want to give people what you don't have. And I'm such a nester now. And like just seeing my kids sleep through the night like a baby without anxiety is just the best feeling in my whole life.
Yeah. And we are also a child-centered family. Like you know, we both grew up with parents that were absent, not out of neglect, but, you know, out of necessity. Right.
Yeah. Like, and so I don't think that a lot of people see parents who are absent as traumatizing, right? You're always like, well, my parents were an alcoholic. You know, parents who work too much. I mean, my parents worked a ton. You know, whether you're high income or low income, it's parents who aren't there emotionally, like you kids need that. They need to know they're emotionally safe. And that, you know, it wasn't until I went to therapy when I quit drinking that my therapist was like, that's traumatic. That what you so went traumatic. Through is traumatic. And I didn't think it was. I was like, I literally was like, why can't I cope with life? What is wrong with me? Was like the running tape in my head.
Yeah, you were never taught any coping skills. I mean, that comes from your family, right? I don't think your housekeeper or your nanny was necessarily teaching you coping skills. Just a guess?
Nope.
Yeah. And it's interesting because my last interview was with Busy from Busy Living Sober. You have to meet her. She's amazing. I'll introduce you. But she also had that experience of idealizing the adults with the parties and the clinking glasses and the giggling and the laughter that's, you know, it's so, and the beautiful dresses and it looks all fabulous, right? Like you don't see what happens, you know, at 2 a.m. when people are puking in the bushes or people are hungover the next day. I mean, obviously not everybody is, but just like that sort of thinking like, oh, that looks so fun type of thing. But I kind of want to go back to some of the things that you were talking about. So that really struck me, the whole absent parent thing, and that you were on your own at such a young age. And you talked about you and your sister not being the soft place to fall. And it's, there was this therapist in the 70s or 80s. His name is Terry Bradshaw, not the football player. But he talked about the baby mobile, like families are like that mobile, meaning the family maintains balance, right? And it's so interesting because, you know, so you were the good girl and seeking attention in a positive way, and your sister was the polar opposite. You guys were keeping balance in the family. And it's interesting because in recovery, when one person starts changing, everybody else doesn't, like everybody has to change to accommodate that balance. So it's really interesting how recovery affects the family later on. But so it sounds like you were the only one that had like a, can we call it an alcohol use disorder?
Oh God. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We'll call it that.
I have no question that I was addicted to alcohol and should never drink again. I mean, there's no, and that the,
you so know, it's just I took, the word alcoholic it's just that you don't the like.
Word. It's just the word.
And it's so funny because it's like the word God, right? It's just, it's an inanimate, it's of itself, it doesn't have, the only meaning that it has is the meaning that you assign to it. And I've heard that if you have a problem with God, typically you have a problem with somebody else's God, right?
Yeah.
Like God is an experiential paradigm. It's,
totally.
You know, it's typically handed down through families because that's a big part of mindset and operating instructions, right?
Yes.
This is how our family operates. Yeah. That's what religion, I think, was intended for. But it's so funny to hear. I know that you had some experience with some, I'm not going to name any names, but some online programs that wholly reject traditional 12-step programs based on this idea of not wanting to break down the ego or rejecting the term alcoholism or, you know, very small parts of a large solution.
Yes.
You know, we talked earlier about some traditional literature that talks about chapter to the wives.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, I'm going to take a stand on this one chapter and wholly reject the whole thing.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's all these feel like, oh, I'm so uncomfortable right now.
I know.
You're very respectful and I don't.
No, I hear you though. And I also, I mean, I do feel like when I was in AA and even now, like I've taken so many of their things to heart and I use them in my daily life. I also coach women who go to AA and I always encourage it. And I encourage women who are not able to stay sober, you know, I always feel like you just need to add layers of support, and AA is a great support. For me, you know, when you were talking about it's just a word, like God, like alcoholic, and it's whatever you apply for it, in my mind, if I don't resonate with that word, or if I don't want to adopt that label, same thing, right? It's just a word. It doesn't change how right. I think about my relationship with drinking. It doesn't change how I identify or know my truth about right. that it does not yeah. work with me, and that it's addictive and it's progressive, and the elevator right. only goes down, to borrow a phrase. But again, it's just a word. And I think if I choose not to use it, that's okay. I mean, I feel like
absolutely.
I yeah. also want to, you know, in coaching, you want to look forward, and I don't want to label myself based on what I don't want. I mean, you know, the idea if you drink again, you'll die. Keep coming, you know, just the idea of fear. I want my life to be lived by my hopes, not my fears. So that's how yeah. I move forward.
No, I really love that. And I don't mean to disparage. I am not by any means disparaging any way that people find solution and peace. And and so I wholeheartedly, because everybody's different. And that's, it's so funny. I feel like I straddle the fence personally, because there's so much of, like, I feel like I see both sides. Like yeah. there's so much to the traditional, ways of recovery that are amazing.
Yes.
Clearly yes. there's lots of things I don't like about it. Like I don't like the dogma. I don't like the, it's interesting because, anonymity is the foundation of a yes. traditional 12-step program, but that also is built in with that is sort of like this shame concept that if you need to keep it a secret, like they say, you're only sick as your secrets, yeah. but let's not tell
and
anybody.
Yet it's
that
a secret.
Yeah. Anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all the, you know, I can.
And I know
it.
That's to protect others, which is so good and true.
Well, but I mean, so it's funny because you like need a safe place at first, yeah. right? When you're just so full of shame, it's like, I need a safe place where I can dump this shit where I know it's not going to, I'm not going to be exposed publicly yeah. before I'm ready. Right. Like, never mind that I drank,
I know,
to a blackout in public at work in front of my boss. And
but like,
you know,
now I'm going to be anonymous, right?
Right. But now it's like, oh my God, I feel so much shame. I can't. So it's just this weird. And so, yeah, it's a very interesting, complex situation, but I do see the need for people to have a safe place. And yeah, it seems like not drinking. It's so weird because like, if you admit at work that you smoke weed, and I think attitudes are changing, like it's like such a bad thing to admit that you do drugs. Yeah. But, if you don't drink, like, ooh, suddenly that's like, oh, yeah. why? What's
what
wrong?
Happened? Are you sure you don't want one? Like, yeah.
No problem.
Absolutely. And yeah, one of so the weird. Reasons that I like the approach I finally took. So, you know, it's not just one thing that helps you stop drinking, right? I did quite a few things. One, I did go to AA and it did help me and it opened my eyes and met good people and realized, you know, I took a lot of those philosophies away and that was a huge part of like the idea that
take
recovery
what you like, leave the rest.
Ruins you for drinking. That, like I said, my online group, I was a member there for the year that I quit drinking, mm-hmm. and the entire time I was drinking, I didn't post because I was embarrassed and felt shame and also felt like it wasn't okay because I didn't have the intention of stopping drinking right then. I wanted to keep drinking, and yet I read, I knew they were there for me. And I remember posting again when I was on day five, when I had, and it was reading the group at 3 a.m. when I woke up the night before was my last day one, that there was someone else on day one and someone else suggested a sober coach. And I wrote them the next day at 10 a.m. So, you know, it was the BFB, my online group, that helped me get sober. It was my sober coach and listening to audios and podcasts and writing her every day and doing coaching calls with her. It was, you know, all the books, the Quitlet books. It was...
Quitlet meaning...
books...
like.
Yeah,
books and memoirs
of women who had quit drinking or telling their stories about drinking and what it, you know, what you do in AA, right? What it was like, what happened, and what's it like now? Like, those are the memoirs. I remember listening to them on audiobooks when I was rocking my daughter to sleep. So you do, you know, even without AA, you immerse yourself in the stories of other women and men. I loved Dry by Augustine Burroughs. Like, that was amazing to me. I listened to Blackout by Sarah Heppala. I listened to, obviously, reread Drinking a Love Story. I, Claire Pooley's The Sober Diary. I mean, all the things, Elizabeth Vargas's Between Breaths, even Abby Wambach's book Forward. She had a drinking problem and is sober. Like, all of those things help me. And it is like AA. You hear their stories. You hear what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And the online connections, you know, similar to AA fellowship, you know, you connect. But for me, also as a working mom with a two-year-old, I was able to listen to that stuff when I was driving to my morning workout on a walk to Starbucks in the middle of the day while rocking my daughter to sleep. I could check the BFB and check in when I was at a work happy hour from the bathroom, when I was at a dinner party and was going crazy. Like, that, I feel like, you know, I truly am an advocate of, like, whatever, if you have a problem with drinking, which I certainly did, whatever helps you stop drinking is what works. And I feel, you know, I feel like in the same way, some people are so loyal to AA and their home group. And of course they are. I feel that way about the BFB. Like, it was whatever helped you in the moment when you were ready to say enough, like that moment of clarity is what was your patchwork of recovery. And I, right now I do share, and I shared long before I became a coach. I would say I used to drink a lot and I quit. I feel better. I sleep better. My anxiety is less. And, you know, a lot of people, that opens up for them, even if they're not about to quit. Like, I've had women be like, oh yeah, I've taken periods without alcohol. I have to watch it too. Like, or I also have anxiety. I totally get that. You know, when you talk about going to therapy and you talk about medications, like, it, you're so much more honest with people and vulnerable. And I don't tell everyone the story because they don't need to hear it and they don't deserve it. But people who are curious, I do share. And I think it helps people when you talk about the anonymity versus just being open, like the way I feel like I am. I've had so many people, I even finally posted on Facebook when I was like a year sober. And one of the big reasons was, I was like, oh yeah, the college girls at rugby, like, it was like a breeding ground for problematic drinking. I mean, there is no question. And I was like, I wonder if any of them are sober. I literally wanted to make old friends and my old coworkers. I was like, yeah, we drank a lot. I wonder if any of them are sober. And I did have some reach out to me.
That's amazing. I did want to ask you about, you know, you talked about rape culture in those, and the cringy songs.
Just in the song.
You were like, oh, you don't want to hear in the lyrics. I was all, hell yeah, I do. Maybe you can send me a little bit of the lyrics and I'll post them in the show notes.
That would, oh my God. Awesome. Do you want me to say them or is that totally inappropriate?
Go ahead and say it. Yeah.
Well, one of them was... shit, damn, fuck, damn, fuck, damn, damn. Some motherfucker just fucked my man. I'll fuck another fucker better than the other fucker. Shit, damn. And another one was like, roll me over in the clover. Roll me over. My poor mother. Roll me over, lay me down, and fuck me hard. Well, you know, like it was true. And I was.
And you managed to be a virgin through all that?
Oh, yeah. I was a total virgin. And it was like. It was like my rebel. And those are like. Some of the better ones, like for real. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Super fun. Okay, send me the X-rated one.
I don't know. That was part of them, but like, why not? Right. Sorry to anyone who, and I'm like such a good girl. Like it was part of my like.
Which is hilarious because, well, I mean, you just can't, it's not human nature to just be so repressed, right? And it's like, you were so repressed for so long, like that had to come out somewhere. I mean, that's why preacher's daughters are always so scandalous. So the Catholic girls are so scandalous sometimes because it's like, repression is not a good thing. It's
I was like able to totally rebel and say the things that I was not doing. In a way that was structured, like in a way that it was like, I guess it's sort of like sororities and fraternities. I wasn't a part of them, but it was like, there was ritual, there was song, like you had the moves that you did. You had the, it was like call and repeat, sort of like church, but totally different, you know?
Yeah. Community and community, but different.
Like being a member of something like, you know,
everybody it's needs not, a tribe.
It was like the girls team and the boys team with the songs, the girls team and the other teams. Like you would go to schools and after the games, we would all sing together. And when you talk about like looking back, oh God, my kids and not, I'm not embarrassed about me. Like I would literally kill them if they ever, like my 12 year old son, like I would just be like, oh no, you didn't. That is rape culture. That is XYZ. That is totally inappropriate. Yeah. Like I was talking to someone and they said nagging wife and I was cringing so upset about the, when I think about the shit that I sang, like, holy crap. So, you know, in the theory of like, when we know better, we do better and frontal lobe development and in 18 year olds is not there and consequences and awareness, like, yikes.
I know. It's like, oh my gosh, kids really do need both parents. They need to be present, you know, and
they need to be made aware of the implications beyond what you say and that it's not harmless. And I'm like raising my hand is like, you thank God there was no social media. Thank God.
Oh my God. I'm so grateful. I got sober before Facebook.
Right.
And smartphones. okay. Well, I'm going to have to list all those books that you mentioned in the show notes. Those are amazing books. The last thing I wanted, and thank you for going there with me about the sort of the traditional 12 steps and this, there is like this new way of recovery that has all the basic structure and principles of 12-step recovery without, you know, the things that you were mentioning. You know, we can reframe a thought and call it alcohol use disorder. We can talk about concepts like you mentioned the hangovers were a distraction from your anxiety. And it's my deepest belief that that is the whole purpose of alcoholism and addiction is to distract us from the suffering. It's like not why the Gabor Mate says, you know, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain. And, you know, it's shifting that focus to something that's more solution oriented, right?
When it's so a maladaptive coping strategy, I mean, you do it because it works for a while. It doesn't work, right?
The price tag, everything comes with a price tag. And the price tag of using alcohol as a coping skill is so high.
The
price tag is too high. And there's other ways of coping that don't have that same sort of price tag. But you talked about, you know, the online groups and having a sober coach. And those, all those things contain the elements required for recovery, you know, the self-examination, the coming to peace with your past, the unpacking the baggage, making restitution. It's like, it doesn't matter where those things happen.
No.
As long as they happen, right?
Oh, and I also did therapy and went on anti-anxiety meds and joined a 5:30 a.m. workout group and worked out four times a week, which helped immensely with my anxiety and also meeting people who didn't drink. I mean, there were so many layers of support in my life that I had to add piece by piece by piece, because when you remove the alcohol, everything that drove you to drink is still there. The way your life is set up, changing how you interact with your boss, how much you give, setting up boundaries, being scared of them, deciding to opt out of relationships that don't lift you up, like all the things. So it is not in any way, I quit drinking because it wasn't working for me. Yes, that's what I did. And then you deal with your habits and your emotions and your anxiety and your friendships and your relationship and boundaries. I mean, you know, all the shit that is a human condition. I actually feel sorry, not sorry, but people who never have to stop drinking often never do this work, which improves their life so deeply.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's really a gift. And, you know, there's this book by Ryan Holiday called The Obstacle is the Way, right? Yeah. And I think of, you know, my journey with alcohol and where it led me and how it's actually transformed my life and made me useful in a way like unique. You are uniquely useful, right? Yeah. Because of your experience. I am uniquely useful because of my experience. And it has opened up a whole new path for both of us, right? And I just want to just focus in on a couple of things you said, because you're really addressing two hugely important things as a, you know, life coach, recovery coach, is just making the decision, getting clarity on, is this a problem, right? Like I remember before I joined a 12-step group that I went through a 2-year period contemplating my drinking. Is it a problem? When did I cross the line? Have I crossed the line? What about all these other people around me that are drinking like me? And like, it started this series of questions, right? But it took me 2 years to overcome this hurdle.
Oh my God. I think it took me like 6 years. So you are fast track there.
I just crashed and burned really hard at a low threshold for pain. I did not manage well. But the other piece as a recovery coach is support to manage that transition for all the reasons that you said. So those, I think, are two huge things, two big ways that you can help people is the coming to the conclusion, like gaining that clarity, and then how to manage it once you make that decision. That's hugely important.
I think it's like holding someone's hand through the process, both helping them see the vision of what they want for their life. Where do they want to go? What do they want? And that is individual, right? I don't tell anyone where they want to go in life. You know how you're feeling now and what you actually hope and dream for your life. And I always say that not drinking is the foundation for everything else you want in life. It is.
Yeah.
If you have a problematic relationship with drinking, remove that and everything else will get better. Your job, your relationship with your kids, your level of anxiety, your sleep, your overall health, your optimism, your marriage. But then there's all the other stuff that was leading you to cope poorly by using alcohol. So then that's where coaching's lovely, to actually say, what are your assumptions and limiting beliefs and fears and all the things keeping you small? And what if you released your potential? And by the way, let's hold your hand through your first dinner party and your first family Christmas, because there's, or holiday, whatever it is, there's all the family stuff there, and through triggers and through job changes and marriage challenges, like all the things, but with a view to not therapy going back to solve underlying dysfunction and understanding why. It's looking forward with coping skills and how do you want to approach this? And is there a healthier way that gets you a better outcome? You know, I love coaching. I go to therapy and I love coaching. They're not either or.
No. I remember one time a friend of mine said, there's like 40 different modalities for healing, and you know, 12 steps was like pretty low on the list. And I was, at first I was all, oh, but then I did the, you know, I had to clutch my pearls. Because part of me is super indoctrinated, right?
Oh my God.
I always have like this very...
I love the image of the people at AA meetings clutching their pearls because it's so counterintuitive and yet I totally see it.
Oh my God. So just a little side story. It's so funny how prudish people can get so quickly.
Considering right? their history, right? Considering the history. Stories you
my
hear.
My favorite line when I'm sharing my story, Saturday night, I'm doing a speaker meeting where I'm speaking for an hour and I'm going to tell the whole story, all the dirt.
Oh.
And I love my favorite line to share because it ruffles people's feathers is that when I was drinking, that if it was in a bottle, a bag, or blue jeans, I was doing it.
I love that.
And the look on people's faces is like, oh my God. And this
what are you like? Tell me you didn't too. Like, whatever.
Bitch, please. I was like, oh my God. And this lady comes up to me one time and she's like, oh my God, I was so embarrassed for you the first time I heard you say that. And I was like, okay, I didn't realize the only virgin in AA was in the room. Sorry. I didn't realize you were currently a nun.
Yeah. That is, I love.
I'm like, you know, you suck the dick.
Okay, apparently this isn't explicit. Although, like, yeah. When I think about my rugby strange. Song. But yeah, that is funny. That is funny.
I was like, come on. Come on. Anyway, I just thought that was hilarious. No, I'm very irreverent, but which, you know, makes things kind of fun, right? It's like, mm-hmm. I like to look at both sides of the thing. Anyway, I digress. back to center.
I was going to say, like, I had you on my podcast and it was all about self-esteem and building up self-esteem. So I'm laughing because yeah. You're like, you know, you sucked a dick. Like that yeah. is cracking me up.
I
right
meant to
now.
Say a strange, you know.
Oh, anyway.
You know, you had the strange. You know,
yes.
I read this one thing on Facebook, one of those stupid memes that every hand that you've ever shaken has had a dick in it.
Yep. But these days so we're funny. Washing our hands like crazy. So we're all okay. Yeah, and not shaking yeah, hands. So, you know.
Yeah. Don't be gross. Oh my goodness, Casey, we'll have to do this again. Cause I still have lots of questions, but sadly we are out of time.
I could talk to you forever. Like that's always the way we are. Well, so
yeah. And maybe, I mean, I think we could do an entire series on how to handle the first time you yes. have sex, the first time you dance, your first yeah. work event, your first, I mean, oh my God, we could have a whole series on that.
Absolutely.
But I want to hear more about 100-day challenge, what all that is. So we'll have to schedule another one and do a part two.
Absolutely. Okay. It's so good to talk to you.
I'm going to leave links to all your stuff so that people can find you. I keep telling you privately, but I'll just say it publicly. Like your message is so clear and you have created this beautiful life. And so you have like knowledge is one thing, but applying it is something completely different. And I see that you have this beautiful life and you've done the work, right? And so you are a testament that recovery and healing can be done as you see fit. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I just know that the ladies who are in your wheelhouse will benefit from spending time with you. So,
oh, thank you so much. And thank you for this podcast. I mean, I love it. And I think it's so important for everyone to hear other people's stories because, as different as they are, the feelings are all the same. And, you know, just to know you're not alone, I mean, wherever you find that connection and that message from people. I mean, that's huge. Like there are so many women and men who have problems with drinking. I mean, it's so universal and it's like the thing that nobody ever talks about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we are turning that ship.
Yes,
around.
We are. Yes, we are. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You have a great day and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
One last thing before you go, if you enjoyed the podcast today, please don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher and leave a review. And if you'd like to make a donation to the podcast and help me keep the lights on, you can do so by visiting odatchat.com. There's a donation button or membership button on the right-hand side. Have a great day. Thank you so much for joining us.